Well, it's been a long week, and the time is ripe for a nap. So how about we all get up for a moment and have the blood moving a little bit? And I'm Italian, so I can relate to postprandial naps so well.
Yeah. When I see their heads go down, I think they're concentrating so hard on what you're saying, they don't want any visual distraction.
That's right. All right. Good. So, you heard Pat giving you a general framework or reference for these cross-jurisdictional sharing initiatives, and then you heard an example from New York State. You will hear another one from Minnesota after me. What I would like to do in the next 15 minutes or so is to go back to a higher level again, and based on what we have learned from the demonstration projects and from reviewing all the other information that was collected in literature that was published and so on, I want to discuss what we have identified as success factors for these projects, and also what we have developed as a sort of pathway to the development of successful cross-jurisdictional sharing projects. And finally, I will give you a little bit of contextual reference about why we think that this matters. So regarding the success factors, essentially the question we asked ourselves was, are there common threads among these projects when they work, when they produce the results that they are expected to produce? And can we distill and describe what those common threads are? And we were able to identify a series of factors. And by the way, before I forget, nobody mentioned that, but there are some handouts in the back on the table, and you will have a list of the success factors here. You will also have a copy of the roadmap, which I will discuss in a moment, and all the slides from all our presentations. So we were able to identify a group, a series of factors that we classified into three groups. One we call prerequisites, which, as the name suggests, these are things that should be in place before you even start the project. Then we identify some factors that are facilitating factors, meaning that they can help. If you have them, use them. If you don't have them, you may have to work a little harder, but you can still make it. And then the third is the project characteristics. How well is your project constructed and built? So let's look at these groups one at a time. In terms of prerequisites, so things that should be there before you can even start, we don't have many of them. We only have three, but they're big ones. The first is clarity of objectives. Before you even start talking about signing agreements and consolidating programs and things like that, I think it sounds like it's an obvious statement, but it's very important to restate it in the open. All the partners need to agree about what they want to achieve. They may come to the table with different expectations, and those different expectations may be reconciled. We'll talk about that again when we talk about the roadmap. So, but those objectives must be clarified before you can start the project. The second prerequisite is having a balanced approach where everybody involved can get some advantage. It's a collaboration among multiple entities, and every entity must put something in, but must also be able to get something out of it. And that approach needs to be balanced in many aspects, including not pursuing just unilaterally saving money or the effectiveness portion of the equation, which is producing and delivering better services. There has to be a balance, because usually different groups, especially policymakers and public health officials, may have different approaches and expectations about what they want to achieve as advantages. And last but not least, and perhaps the most important one, is trust. And Don alluded a little bit to that. Having a history of trust already present among the partners is extremely important. Trust is not very easy to build if you don't have it at the beginning of the project. It's also sometimes very easy to lose. It's really a prerequisite. I mean, it's not possible to run these projects if all the parties that are involved don't trust each other, because there are so many traps and pitfalls into which people may fall if we don't trust each other. So those are the things, really, the prerequisites, things that absolutely must be there, or chances are your project is not going to work. Then there are the facilitating factors. If you have those, you should capitalize and build on those. You should use them to your advantage. Success in prior collaborations, again, going back to what Don was saying earlier, this may be very well the first time that your partners come together for a project like this, but chances are that actually there is more going on that has gone on in the past among the same partners, and that should be recognized. That should be brought up to the spotlight and discussed in the open, also to understand what worked and what didn't work, but particularly if you have some success that you have achieved, that can be a very reassuring element for those stakeholders who may be a little reluctant at the beginning to embrace this concept of engaging to this process. Another facilitating factor, if you have it, use it, is the concept of regional identity. And Paul alluded a little bit to that, but we have seen that very strong in some other projects as well. There are some instances in which some jurisdictions are used to working each other to a point that they can identify themselves as one region, even though that region may not have a jurisdiction per se, they may not have a proper elected governance body, but they know that they are together in this. They have done things together in transportation, in law enforcement, in other sectors before they're coming to public health. So if there is this sense of regional identity, use it to your advantage to show people we are doing something together, again, just like we have done in other instances and in other fields. And then the positive personal relationships. Now, you know, you can call these facilitating factors. Somebody could argue this is almost like a prerequisite. But let's face it, not all of us are equally good at negotiating. And some people actually are not good at all. And those are not the people that you want to send to the table to talk to the other stakeholders about these type of agreements. So having people that can work with each other, and ideally that already have a story of working with each other, history of working with each other, as individuals, as persons, not just as jurisdictions, as individual representatives, I think it may really help your project very much. And the third group of success factors are project-related characteristics. Having a senior-level support, every project should have some senior-level support. Now, that doesn't mean that the boss has to be involved in each and every meeting. Actually, I would argue probably the boss doesn't need to be involved in each and every meeting. But the boss needs to be very well informed about what's going on, what the plans are. And the boss also needs to send a clear message down throughout the agency. This is something that I want to see happening. This is something important to me, to management. You are not just doing that on your own and, you know, try to find out something else to do. This is something that I want to see. So that's a level of support that you are really hoping to have. These are complex projects. There are a lot of moving parts. You heard a little bit about that, and you will hear more from Sandy, from her project in Minnesota. They're complex projects that really require good project management skills. So ideally, you can have a project manager on board whose probably almost only task may be to manage the different components and make things happen in the right order, in the right sequence. But that's definitely something you may want to pay attention. It's more complex than just running individual programs like probably you have done in your single individual health department before. Now, project management is different from change management. Another component of these projects is that they produce a lot of changes, as you can imagine. And those are changes both at the institutional level and for single individual workers. Am I going to have a job? What is my job going to look like? Do I have to commute now to next country every morning to go to work? There is a lot of stress related to these questions. And it's important to have a plan in place on how to manage those changes. And there is actually something that I wasn't aware of this until we started working on this project. There is a whole branch of science, if you will, that look at change management. They look at how you can help people and institutions go through profound changes in their institutional lives or individual lives. And a lot of that revolves around communication. So all these elements are all linked together. Probably the vast majority of the change management plan is going to be around communication. Just being able to have good two-way communications with everyone who is involved in these changes is extremely important. It will achieve a lot of what you want to achieve through the change management plan. So these are the factors for success. So if you look at this as a whole unit, you can try to see when you are starting a new project, where am I standing with all these factors and what do I need to build more to assure a better success? And based on that, we ask the question, is there a way that we can show, is there a pathway that we can show, that we can build, we can demonstrate for people who want to start these new projects? And we developed something that we call the roadmap. And again, there are copies there in the back. And really was developed by us at the center, but was based a lot on what the 19 demonstration sites had produced and what we had learned from them. We could not have done this roadmap before those 19 projects were well halfway into their lifespan. They had their handouts, it's also available online. The logic model, if you will, of that pathway that we have developed includes three phases. The first is exploration. That's where you ask the question, is this even a feasible approach that we want to take and to consider? The second is preparation and planning. How exactly is this going to work? And the third, you actually do it, you implement it. Now you can see those thick arrows in the left. What those mean is that we believe, based on what we have observed, that you should move from phase 1 to 2 and from 2 to 3 in that order. And one a problem that we have seen at the beginning of some of the projects, demonstration projects, they tended to jump to phase 2 without spending sufficient time of phase 1. What they miss in practice is they were starting to worry about things like what exactly is the legal language we are going to use for our agreement, and what kind of phone systems are we going to use if we share a program, and what computer system you're going to use. That's a part of the prepare and plan. But if you go there without first establishing clarity about what kind of approach you want to take, what kind of expectations you're going to have, that may fail you. So the order here is important. Now the dotted lines on the right mean that if at any point you realize that you are at phase 2 or 3 and you have either neglected some steps in a prior phase, or you need to just revisit those steps because of changing circumstances in your environment, including maybe having some new elected officials on your team, it's perfectly okay to trace your steps back and go back up. But the idea is that you go from 1 to 2 and from 2 to 3. And these tables are taken from the document that's there in the back. I'm not going to read line by line, of course. I'm just going to give you an overview of each of the three phases. So the first one, again, is all about why you should consider a cross-jurisdictional sharing agreement. What kind of services and capacity, generally speaking, are we willing to share? What's on the table? What should not be on the table? What should we agree just now when we begin? We are not going to talk about sharing HIV service. It's not on the table. We are not interested right now. Let's talk about public health preparedness instead, just to give you some examples. And the third element is the who. Who should be involved in this conversation? Now, keep in mind that who means stakeholders, and the definition of stakeholders is everyone who has something at stake. So the who may go beyond who is around the table when you have your first meetings. The who may involve people in your community, may involve other agencies and entities that do work with your health departments, but anyone who is affected by the changes that you're ready to introduce should really be considered as a stakeholder. Then you're going to phase two, the prepare and plan. That's where the planning phase really starts, and you start talking about what kind of initiatives we have done in the past, if we can learn from them, what kind of governance do we want to have. How are we going to make a decision? Who has the power to make a decision? Who has the power to dissolve this agreement? How are we going to do it? If we hope this is going to work. If it doesn't work, is there a way out, an exit strategy that we can use? What are the fiscal and service implications? Is there that balance between effectiveness and efficiency that we know is an important success factor for these projects? What kind of legal sharing agreements do we need to have? That's the time to involve your attorneys. But here, now, not at the beginning. Only after you have established the ground rules on what you want to do and why, that's the right time to do that. Are there other legal issues are there union issues that we need to consider in these sharing agreements, liability and insurance? That's where really the detailed mind frame becomes very helpful. What kind of phones we are going to use, what kind of IT system, and so on. And that's why this list is extremely long. The planning phase is really all about details. Logistical issues, where are people's offices and desks going to be located? How are we going to communicate? Who are the external audiences? Who are the stakeholders that I was talking about earlier, who may not be at this table right now, but nevertheless, we need to involve? Do we have a change management plan? Who is going to be affected by these changes? And how are we going to help these people to navigate through the change? Timeline and monitoring. Well, the timeline is pretty obvious. And monitoring, it's important to discuss at this point. These are, in many instances, these are relatively new and aggressive programs. It's important to have a good monitoring system in place. So if something doesn't work in the good spirit of quality improvement, you can go back and modify your plan. But you need to think about the monitoring system while you're doing your planning. Well, then finally, this part is easy, right? You just do it. It's not that easy, I know. But you notice how short it is. Because really, if you've done your work, your homework up front, then at this point, it's only, quote unquote, a matter of doing what you said you were doing. See if that produces the results that you wanted. And make sure that people are satisfied with those results, those stakeholders, that those expectations that you have clarified at the beginning have been met or are being met. And of course, you need to implement the monitoring system that you had discussed earlier and planned for earlier. So this is our roadmap. And when we put it out, about a year and a half ago, not even that long, actually. Not even a year now. It feels like it's been much longer. It was received pretty well by our demonstration projects, but the first question, of course, I ask, okay, now you told us that we have to do all this stuff. You're going to help us? How are we going to do all this? And so there was a request, of course, for tools and instruments and resources that they could use. And what we did was identify some of those resources that already existed, but perhaps even more, we have developed our own tools and resources. And what we have done is linking those resources to specific steps of the roadmap. So if you go on our website, you will find this table where for each of the different areas and examples or issues to consider, you will find one or more resources listed. And if you click there, that's where you would go. So if you know that your issue is that you want to work on trust, you find the step where trust is discussed, and then you click on the link and you will find some tools that will help you on how to work with trust. Finally, why are we doing all this? This is what we call the uncomfortable question, and sometimes we show this slide, sometimes we don't, because it can make some people uncomfortable. But it's a reality. Depending on which day you count them, we have roughly, give and take, 2,500 local health departments in this country. Can we afford to have that many? Can we imagine a day when all of them will have enough quality in their services they can meet accreditation standards? And on the other hand, how feasible it is to just overhaul this entire system and come up with something totally different? That's where I think our concept of sharing agreements can play an important role to address these challenges here. I'm not going to spend much time on this, but there is a clear link between what we are doing and quality improvement and accreditation. Sharing agreements can actually provide a support for documentation of meeting certain standards for the purpose of accreditation, and can also sometime accreditation, we found this from a couple of our projects. They said we were not sure, we had several areas we wanted to examine for shared services, but we found that some of them were a little tricky, there were different expectations. We decided to start from something that none of us has done before, which is getting ready for accreditation. So we're going to start working together on accreditation, going through our accreditation standards and see how we can work together on those. And finally, what's next? The Center for Sharing Public Health Services has funding through June 2015. We are in active conversations with Robert Wood Johnson Foundation to start what we call the phase two of the center, and there are all good indications that that will happen. And during phase two, some of the questions that we would like to address are shown on this slide. Most of what we have worked on so far has been on local-to-local agreements, with the state sometimes having a facilitating role, but it's really local-to-local. The models that we have identified and the success factors we have described here today, we do not know to what extent those are applicable to state-to-state agreements, state-to-tribal, tribal-to-local, tribal-to-tribal. So all the other contextual different partners that you can imagine. So that's something that we think there is a lot of material there that's portable, but we don't know for a fact. What are the fiscal implications? And we are already doing some work along those lines. How much does it cost to provide certain services as an individual health department? How much does it cost to provide the same service as a joint shared effort? And how are we going to share the costs? Is it going to be 50-50? Is it going to be per capita? What is it going to look like? Is there a way that we can classify some of those agreements in a more organic way so that they're not all different from each other? And somewhat related to that, is there a way that we can define success in a way that goes beyond a single project? So far, we have defined success as if the project achieves the goals that the project had established at the beginning, the project is successful. But maybe there are higher level success factors that we can identify, and then we can apply to individual projects.